this podcast from Adelaide Place Baptist Church. We are a community of disciples, apprentices of Jesus, who live and work in the city of Glasgow, and it's our vision to join God in the renewal of all things. Our discipleship to Jesus is for all of our lives, so as well as listening to this podcast, we'd love for you to join us on a Sunday morning or get involved in one of our missional communities, which are across the city throughout the week. Our prayer is that you encounter Jesus in some way through this podcast. More information can be found at apbc.net.
Well, good morning. Allow me to interrupt your nice welcome and embrace of each other. My name's Stephen. I'm the pastor here at Adelaide Place. I want to give you all a really warm welcome, whether, you know, first time or a millionth time here, you're all really welcome. And I'll throw in my little tuppence worth of, you know, when you're, maybe for those people who are new to a city, Glasgow was actually my first choice when I, for university, and I ended up getting my second choice, which ended up took me to Aberdeen, and now I end up in Glasgow. And isn't it funny how you just have to kind of rest in God's plans for your life and just trust that he knows what he's doing? And one of the things we actually say to people, from time to time put on newcomers, sort of get together meal things, just to help people orientate to life in Adelaide Place and Glasgow. And we often would speak about the story of Jeremiah and the exile and this strange message that Jeremiah gives to people who were taken away from their home and placed in a foreign land against kind of their will. And he says, stay there, put roots down there, take wives, build homes, you know, seek the welfare of the city, and in that you'll find your welfare. And one of the things that kind of draw out in that, though there's many other things as you look at the Gospels, is just this idea of being rooted in place and actually going with, you know, the providence of God, his plans, his purposes over all things. And actually, the shorthand that was what I say to that is, look, act like you could be here forever, because for some of you, you will. You just don't know it yet. You could be here. Some of you just think that sounds like a life sentence, by the way, but for some of you, actually, you could be here for longer than you think. And let's be a people. We follow Jesus, who is incarnate and who kind of moved into the neighborhood. Let's be rooted in time and place, committed and belong well. Wherever we end up church-wise, but in our communities and in our neighborhood, let's not just be living always in airport mode, always just passing through. Let's be rooted. And so you might only be here for a year. You might only be here for 6 months. I get that. You know, we're not taken captive of you. But wouldn't it be awesome if we could all just, you know, be really rooted and act like we might be here forever, because God's got a sense of humor, hasn't he? And here we end up in Glasgow. So you join us kind of just at the start, kind of middle of a series that we've called Practicing the Way of Jesus. The emphasis is on practice, not just knowing. So the blessing, as we said the first couple of weeks, is in the doing, in the obedience, not just collecting ideas, but actually as we step out and obey. And that's what we're thinking about. And this week, we've had a couple of weeks warm up in that, setting the scene as we head into that. But we're actually thinking about a specific practice as we gather today, and a practice that will come in and will hit your inbox later on at the start of this week. For those of you who know, by the way, if you want to sign up for being involved in just the general know-how of Adelaide Place and the specific resources that are coming out at the minute attached to the series, then somebody will be over there with a device that can sign you up to, you know, the rest of your life sort of thing. So this morning, we begin with a specific practice, and I want us to explore the idea that the God who rests is also the God who liberates. And we're going to think of the interplay between Sabbath rest and liberation as we approach this specific practice that I say will hit your inbox around the practice of Sabbath. And so in order to set up the practice, I want to survey some important biblical moments when it comes to Sabbath to get at this rest that leads to liberation. And it's a theme we're not just going to dive into only this week. We're going to come at it a number of times. The bit of the catchphrase that we stole from another church about this series is being with Jesus, becoming like him, and doing the things he did. There's a progression that you see in that, this idea of being with him. And the first block that we're in at the minute there's a massive emphasis on being with Jesus, is that time and enter into that rest. So this theme of Sabbath, we're going to come at a few different times. I don't know what Sabbath brings to mind for you, in case you haven't realized and you're wondering. So I am Northern Irish, and so Sabbath to me means a really specific thing. It almost makes me laugh. And I think back to Sabbath growing up in Northern Ireland, the sort of the day off, the Sunday thing. It was suited and booted, the big Presbyterian church. We had lovely free Presbyterian neighbours who we always knew they didn't do sport or watch TV on the Sunday, so we had to play around the other side of the garden not to, you know, wind them up, because they, you know, we're all good church people and stuff like that. You know, it brings to mind me the memory of just sitting at the dinner table in that sort of formal setting. Dad would do the dishes on a Sunday for some reason, didn't lift a finger the rest of the week. No offense, Dad. He doesn't listen, he's fine. And, you know, it'd be roast beef and gravy and sometimes pork, always tough. Mum always made tough pork. She never mastered that. But the roast beef was good. And the potatoes, because we're Irish, you know, we had lots of potatoes kicking around. And it was formal, and often we had people over who were stifling, but yet we'd be there having fun. And, you know, that was Sabbath to me. I'll be honest, and then there was the sacred moment in the day where you got to watch the Grand Prix, and you're like, sod it, you got to at least watch the Grand Prix, and that was just Sabbath for me, slightly boring, slightly formal, but actually good food in there, and, you know, it's a lot of Northern Irish things, and we're not going after recreating the Northern Irish Sabbath, nor are we ruling it out completely. The shops were closed, you know. It was just a really special thing. So I don't know what it brings up for you when you think about Sabbath. It might be slightly formal, who knows. But I think there's our collective conscience in the world, not just, you know, with people of faith, is maybe getting a bit more au fait with actually this idea of, which brings up for me Sabbath, rest and order and rhythm. And, you know, I'm drawn to just some examples of, you know, people outside of the Christian bubble, as it were, who just seem to be signs of the world that actually, oh, there's an order thing. It's not all about activity. I don't know why I follow Richard Branson on Instagram. You know, he's got a bit of money. He might help us with the building project someday. Who knows? But I just remember there's a clip in his, it's basically a day in the life of Richard Branson. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. And, you know, you think somebody who's a successful, runs his many businesses, what does a day in the life of Richard Branson look like? And it's interesting, he gets up at 6, and I think it began with tennis with a friend, and just relaxing, a bit of tennis, you know, 6:30 tennis, that's what I do. Now, there's a backdrop of an island, right, just a bit of reality here, a backdrop of island and sun, and, you know, probably somebody paid to play tennis with him, like Federer or something, just to warm up in the morning. And then he'd just go about his day, blah, blah, blah. And then at the end of the day, it's a massive part to us is actually gathering and feasting and getting friends together and wine and just enjoying and telling stories about the day. And I was like, it's funny, you know, take away the billions of pounds from that story. And just there's something actually of a collective consciousness, I think, in the world that we start to see. People are starting to get, there is more to life than just the rat race in the sense of doing all the time. And little wonder that this first appearance of the Sabbath is actually in Genesis 2, the creation narrative. So I say little wonder because it's a sense of with the grain of not just a cultic practice of Israel or a church, it's actually with the grain of what it means to be truly human, is to have this idea of order and rest at the core of who we are. Hence why Genesis says, thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array 6 days, but the seventh day God had finished the work he had been doing. On the seventh day he rested from all his work. And then God blessed the seventh day, made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. Turn with me, if you will, to Deuteronomy 5, 1 to 12. A couple of moments. There's also an Exodus moment, but there's a Deuteronomy moment I want to start with. And we'll read 1 to 12 just now. The words should be on the screen. So this is Moses summoning all of Israel together, and we'll we'll just go for it. So hear, Israel, the decrees and the laws I declare in your hearing today. Learn them and be sure to follow them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. It was not with our ancestors that the Lord made his covenant, but with us, with all of us who are alive here today. The Lord spoke to you face to face out of the fire on the mountain. At that time, I stood between the Lord and you to declare to you the word of the Lord, because you were afraid of the fire and didn't go up to the mountain. And he said, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy, as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, your male or female servant, nor your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns, so that your male and female servants may rest as you do. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath. I want us just to observe the realities and remind. You get the sense of reminder in this articulation of the Ten Commandments, and in the fourth commandment that we're focusing on Sabbath. And it's a reminder, and I want us then to remind ourselves of the realities of Egypt that were. But in the recent memory of the people of Israel, so that we can maybe hear this command in the realities of that context. And this fourth commandment is presented in the midst of the sort of mighty ten. And for those of you who will know the story of the Old Testament, you'll understand that Israel was in captivity in Egypt. Egypt was a place they went to for refuge. Remember Joseph and his technicolor dream coat and all that? Well, they paraded into Egypt and they were friends and it all went well with them. But then, you know, Joseph passed away and time carried on and Israel got bigger and more fruitful and they multiplied physically and Egypt started to feel threatened by them. And so their plan was, we know what we're going to do with you. We're not going to look after you, Hebrew people. We're going to exploit you and we're going to take you as more as human slaves, and we're going to drive you into the ground, and you're going to make bricks for us, and you're going to produce for us, and we are going to lord over you. And they had run out of favor, and the Egyptians were taking advantage of them, and the Israelites were living as slaves. And just as a reminder of some of this, as I want us to think of some of the rhetoric of the times that they were just in so recently, they had just been come out of, into that great story of the Exodus, into the desert, and into this journey towards the promised land. The rhetoric of the time, and the best place I think it can go in this is Exodus 5, where you just get this firm reminder of what the people of God were once under, were recently under. So Exodus 5:5 says this, Exodus 5:4, why are you taking the people away from your work? Get to your labors. Exodus 5:5, yet you want them to stop working. You shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves, but you shall require of them the same quantity of bricks as they made previously. Do not diminish it, for they are lazy. Let heavier work be laid on them, verse 9. Then they will labor at it and pay no attention to deceptive words. I will not give you straw. Go and get the straw yourselves, wherever you can find it, but your work will not be lessened in the least. Complete your work on the same daily assignment as when you were given straw. Why did you not finish the required quantity of bricks yesterday and today as you did before? No straw is given to your servants, yet they say to us, make bricks. You are lazy, lazy. That is why you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord. Go now and work, for no straw will be given to you, but you shall still deliver the same number of bricks. you shall not lessen your daily number of bricks. Walter Brueggemann, an Old Testament scholar, just points to this language, and he says the rhetoric of this point is relentless. This is a mixture of the complaints of Israel and the lords over them, driving them to make more and more bricks, making it harder and harder and harder. And this is the rhetoric of that moment in that time. But there was also a socioeconomic system and practices. The Pharaoh had no rest as he monitors daily production. The supervisors had no rest because they were the taskmasters set to keep on top of the slaves. And the slaves, Israel, had no rest either because there was this dogged commitment to make Pharaoh's glory increase. The economy reflects the splendor of Egypt and the splendor of Pharaoh, and therefore the Egyptians' glory is bound up in these socioeconomic policies and the cultural norms and practices. This was an oppressive social reality that the whole country was caught up into, if not least the people of God. And it was very clear in this, through the language, but in the system, that there can be no Sabbath rest in a system like that. And the net sum of this is another observation by Walter Brueggemann, the Old Testament scholar, is that there was a dramatic loss of imagination among the people of an alternative way. And we see this manifest even in the moment when there's the people of God are, if you can shortcut the story and say that all the miracles that were done, if you've seen the sort of the Exodus story on the big screen or you've read your Bible, there's a moment when they've been led out, they're in the desert, and it's a tough moment, okay? They're having a tough time. But the people actually said, look, we want to go back. We prefer it the old way. We want to go back to why did you bring us out of this? We said we'd be happy to stay under these old lords. Leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians. And Moses answered the people, do not be afraid. Stand firm and you'll see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you'll never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. So there's this moment, they're trying to be led into something that Yahweh is wanting to bring into the blessing for them. But yet there's such a loss of imagination of an alternative way that all they can think of is more bricks. We'll just go back to more bricks, live under the system. There's no other way. This is the only way. So there was a relentless rhetoric. There were specific socioeconomic systems and cultural norms, practices, and there was a dramatic loss of imagination of an alternative way. And it's funny, sometimes these ancient stories, I think, when you get at the deep undercurrents of what's going on, suddenly become very relevant. I was thinking about these things in terms of if that was then, and think about now. Because who cares in some level about then? Because this is now, right? Is there a relentless rhetoric today now? What would that sound like in our culture? Do you know, I like podcasts, and I've been diversifying my podcasts more recently. I don't know why. I know next to nothing about economics, and the leadership team can vouch for that. Every time a spreadsheet comes out and I look at it, it seems to go on fire or something. I have no idea what that's about. But I've been listening to The Guardian's podcast on economics, which has been absolutely mind-blowing and brilliant for a novice like me. And there's this amazing podcast around GDP and its place as basically the case was being put forward. It's a rubbish measure of doing well. And it was a measure brought out in a wartime to try and maximize wartime effort. There's many other better and brilliant metrics that actually bring about a healthy society and a healthy culture. And I'm not getting into the ins and outs of that, nor am I qualified to do that. But I am interested in the rhetoric that seems prevalent of the bottom line. The rhetoric of the bottom line around produce and money being the foundation, if you like, of what it means to be doing well. And it begs me to think, is that a rhetoric today, and is there another way? But that's political systems, and there's a macro thing. But there's also, I think, a rhetoric now that points to something of a relentless thing in a personal way. And I think questions of what you're going to do over what sort of person you're going to become is an example of that, or how are you going to make your dent in the world over how are you going to add value to your brief sprint through this world? And I think it's also expressed in the language of tiredness. Or do you know how many times you've heard you say, oh, we should really catch up? And then in your head, you're going, we're never going to catch up. There's no time to catch up. Or I'm just busy, I'm tired. And you're like, yeah, you said that 5 years ago. Busy, tired. And the language I hear at times in my own life and in our community can sound relentless too. I wonder what about now in terms of socioeconomic systems and practices. You could point to things, whatever you think of universal credit, the strengths and weaknesses of that. Education is a system, isn't it? There's schools that will only shoot for certain subjects and for certain grades. It's a reality. Is that good? Is that helpful? Who knows? There's mortgages. There's car PCP payments that are the practice, a cultural norm of how we set ourselves up. There's interior design. You know, it's going through the roof. The expectations are high these days. Pinterest has knocked out of the park. We're all interior designers. There's Amazon, which is just another shorthand for this sort of acquisitiveness of a culture that's, you know, we can get instantly Amazon Prime, we can get this tomorrow, it's all at our fingertips. We've lots of socioeconomic systems and cultural norms and practices today. And I think also today we can have the sense of a loss of imagination, which sounds like, how are you? Yeah, busy. Or achievement too narrowly defined for kids. And kids, I'm thinking kids in their kids' clubs, and like, gee whiz, are they going to be a professional footballer? Are they going to be a professional badminton player, a swimmer? Achievement can be so narrowly defined. And, I hear the loss of imagination sometimes among us as parents, and I include myself in that. Paul never had any kids, or Jesus, if he had kids, then it might seem a bit more realistic. On the one hand, I get that, by the way. Claire and I, honestly, never really got out of survival mode for the young family bit. I think we're thinking about it a wee bit afresh but I don't want you to hear, a big stick. We just never really, it's survival, and I don't know what to say about that. But I do know there's some of these loss of imagination, because behind those statements is saying there's actually no other way here. This is the way things are. Stop poking us to think there's actually an alternative here. It's careers, houses, car, all these things define. And if we're not careful, then this all can start to sound awfully like more bricks. More bricks, more bricks. And so the question at one point is, so what's the contrast Yahweh wanted his people to feel with these reminders? The contrast between Yahweh, if you like, and Pharaoh. And of course, Yahweh speaks in the language of covenant, which is about relationship over things like bricks and output, which is commodity. Yahweh comes and speaks in those words. Yahweh is not a workaholic. Yahweh is erupting with an alternative way, a better way. He's trying to draw them on. Be still, I'll fight for you. He's trying to draw them in, if you know your Old Testament, to a jubilee system where every 7 years debts will be canceled and the poor will be taken care of and there will be a plenty for everybody. He's trying to draw them in to an alternative way. And Yahweh is not anxious about the full functioning of creation. The well-being of creation is not dependent on endless work. In fact, in this moment, we're starting to see how endless work is actually destroying creation by the endless productivity and our raping of the earth. Commodity is destroying this world. And so this Sabbath commandment, when it was first heard, was about identity, which was another way of saying, you're not what you produce. You do not have to be a slave to the system. You are worth more than your output. You've been created to be with God, one with God, and in neighborly community with each other. You are God's people. You are my people who are chosen and loved. You are worth more than bricks. And it's the contrast of the systems. The Pharaoh and the Egyptian gods versus the relationship and life of Yahweh. which should hopefully make us at least think if we're here, okay, again, a bit, that was then, this is now. What's this got to do with us if we're followers of Jesus? And there's a sense, a very strong sense in the New Testament that Jesus was fulfilling what was an echo in the Old Testament. Jesus was bringing to his ultimate fruition and climax in the New Testament. He was doing a greater exodus. Matthew 2 puts it like this, about the Holy Family, Joseph and Mary coming out of Egypt. The Holy Family came. It's a really important moment to say, look, Jesus is not some abstract person. He is filling up all these promises of the New Testament. And when the Holy Family come out of Egypt, he's saying, Jesus is doing an even greater rescue, a greater exodus. He is doing it on a greater scale. It's not just he's forgiven sins and then you go off to heaven and you die. He is doing a greater liberation that is restoring this earth and bringing heaven and earth back together. And so in some ways, the greater exodus is greater in scale and scope. It's not just a people, a specific people tied to one land. It's the whole world Jesus came to save, to unite heaven and earth. It's on an incredible scale. And he was offering the pinnacle and definition of Sabbath. And he too, Jesus came questioning all loyalties and rescuing us from oppressive idols. Jesus too was wanting to save and reorder our lives around a communion with God that manifests in love of God and love of neighbor. And so Jesus comes to us and he says, for whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world, bricks, and yet forfeit their soul? And here's the point for Israel and for anyone who wants to follow Jesus today. And it's this, that there is no real Sabbath if we're still tied to the old regime. You are worth more than what you achieve. You are worth more than what you accumulate. You're worth more than what others may say about you. You're worth more than what your job title says to you. But we need to respond and we all need to decide in our lives, who is in control here? What are we living for? What are we tied to? I'm not worried when I hear you say I spent the whole weekend studying and revising for an exam on Monday or something like that. I'm not worried. I'm not approaching this in a legalistic way. But see, even the second time you say that, and the third time, and the fourth time you say that, I'm starting to see a habit forming, and I'm curious at that stage about that. I'm not worried if in first and second year picking on the students today, if you overcommit and are on every committee and leading everything. It's part of life. I'm sitting, getting slightly more worried third, fourth year into the world, what habits are turning into lifestyle. I'm not worried if I do up my house well, get good things in it, but when cyclical patterns of expenditure and stretch and living beyond our means becomes a thing, well, maybe there's something to think about. And I genuinely do get excited when I hear people excited about their career, and we've celebrated that. We've had a series on work. We love loving work, even on a bad Monday, but if we're not careful, the tyranny of performance sneaks up on us very easily and dominates our lives. And so the questions become uncomfortable but real and could sound like this. Who or what vision of the good life is defining your schedule? What idols might be lurking behind some of your most subtle decisions? And in your busyness, is there any darkness that you are running from that the light of Christ can overcome? You see, this is just setting up this practice to say our deepest loyalties will emerge as we push into this practice. Do you know, and I think good outcomes, just a bit of help you pace your way through this as you're all going to be diving into some of these practices through over the next few weeks. A good outcome for this is not suddenly I was a really bad boy or girl and I'm suddenly being a really good boy or girl. I'm doing the exercises. Look at me, pat yourself on the back. That's just not realistic, right? You're not suddenly going to leave the old regime and just throw it all off and suddenly be all brand new. But a good outcome is when you start to go, like, oh, hold on a minute. I'm starting to get a handle on a few things that's going on. I'm starting to see patterns. I'm starting to see a few things that are driving my life. These are the sorts of things that we can realistically expect over the next few weeks as we make space to practice the way of Jesus, seeing our deepest loyalties emerge. And so let me turn to the specific practice. We are, I think, called to be a prophetic enactment of another way. Imperfect, but a living example that there is another way to live. And so it's not Richard Branson. I don't suppose it'll be tennis in the morning and, you know, a party in the evening for some. But it could sound like this. So the Sabbath guidelines and how might this practice go? So you are going to get a really, like, when I say spell out, there's a really specific practice going to hit your inbox. Get excited about that, but it's literally step one is this, step two is this, step three. So the details are coming, the how-to is going to be clear, but here's some guidelines at broad strokes if we're going to put some of these things in practice. Because there's the first one is it has to be concrete. Because there's a sense here we could get very vague and talk about this reign of God, this posture of our hearts, this rhythm and order, and keep it, you know, I'm just Sabbath on the inside, you know, stillness amidst chaos, and I'm doing all that in a very broad sense. Because there's a sense the Sabbath is coming under the reign of Christ. But it's also a concrete practice of a 24-hour period, and it's tangible. You have to be able to describe it without, you know, people going like, yeah, I think you're at it a wee bit. So it has to be concrete, and the second thing, it needs designed. So it needs to, for it to work, it needs to be designed to do what needs done to allow you to do what to step in the wrestling. So it's going to need a bit of design to it. It needs to be concrete. It needs to be designed. And the third thing is it needs to be neighborly. It's not a middle class bourgeois sort of a, you know, do our nails and go a bit of kite surfing and it might be that for some, and I'll join you in that. But it's not just about that. There's something of the responsibility, and I would even put it like this. I think the Bible would back me up in this. I think there's more of a responsibility on the rich people among us to build in reserves that brings relief for the less well-to-do in our community. I just think that's biblical 101 stuff of what it means. If the and you can decide who's rich and who's not. I'm not going to decide, but I'll leave that with you. So there's a sense of it's to be neighborly. It's not to be like, this is not my time. This is an invitation to participate in the kingdom. And so if there's not a something of an output of a neighborliness that comes out of our Sabbath, then perhaps there's something misshapen about it. And the fourth thing, it's concrete designed, it's neighborly, and it's to be godly, not in an ordinary godly sense of, you know, no TV and all that. But, you know, I love Eugene Peterson's thing of delighting in the goodness of God. He talks about Sabbath in terms of play and pray. And that will all mean different things for you and I. You know, your idea of play, you know, might be my idea of like a horror show and vice versa. There's an idea, but it's not just you going and, you know, boss it in the gym and ignoring church or whatnot. It's got that God piece, but it's got play and it's got prayer, and those two things come together. So it works perfectly well watching the rugby before church and then coming to pray. Do you know? That's not meant to be smug, but you know, these two things can sit together quite nicely. And so we can come pray and play. Somebody put it like this. It spoke powerfully into, I think, my life about 3-4 years ago. I heard Pete Gregg, I think I said this before, I heard Pete Gregg describe, he gave this story of, I think it's his mum, who drove from the south of England to Scotland one time. And what they realized was she drove the entire way from the south of England to Scotland in third gear. And he said the car was like screaming, it was like smoke, it was just like the whole time that the engine noise was just like, rah, 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 rah. And they got to Scotland and the engine was like, literally was smoking and it was insane and it took them forever and the fuel stops and all that sort of thing. And he says, do you know something? there's something about this idea of just changing gear could have got us there a lot quicker and a lot faster. And he said this, here's how you need to change gear. And the two things, and I was waiting for some, you know, recipe for, you know, here's how to be a successful person. And he says, you can change gear when you practice Sabbath and when you spend more time developing friendship. And I was just like, that was not what I was expecting you to say. I thought it was going to be a program. I thought it was going to be intense. I thought it was going to sound heavy. And he said, you will change gear, go farther and faster and better with less engine damage when you build in Sabbath. He's speaking to leaders and build in more friendship, time your friends. Fundamentally, took me 3 years to start walking in that in an embryonic way. Just to pace us again. Some of us are so tied to the system that this isn't going to just go like, oh, that makes sense, off we go. It took me personally, I think, about 3 years to even start to be confidently go like, do you know, I think I'm actually walking in that imperfectly, but may we hear what the Spirit is saying to us this day. But may we also, for some of us, for some of you, it's more decisive than that. There's a gradual, but there's an exchange of idols of what we're living for. And some of you would think, what does it mean to follow Jesus? Do you know, I maybe heard some things about the cross, but what does it actually mean to follow Jesus? I don't know where to start. And actually, there is a starting point, a decisive point, where people talk about giving your life to Jesus. What they mean is an exchange of what we are living for, be it success, be it just money, be it, you know, living for yourself, but list whatever the thing is. And the decision isn't about fixing everything, but it's deciding, I don't want that. I want to go the way of Jesus, the way of love, and the way he's shown me in the cross of Christ. And so for some of you, it's, what do I need to turn from to take hold of that? And for many of us, maybe that's a return, or maybe that's a starting point to say, actually, do you know what? May the Spirit just be specific with us in our hearts to help us know how to, what we're needing to turn from to take fully hold of this way of Jesus. And may we hear how he would lead us this morning. Let's pray together.